You're listening to the TrekMate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. And tonight's episode is The Naked Now. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
Synopsis is, Gene Roddenberry was trying to tell a really racy story, but realized he was just too old to imagine such a thing. So instead, he decided to retell one from 22 years ago. Oh, wait. That's my synopsis, I should mention. The real synopsis is, the crew of the Enterprise is subjected to an exotic illness that drives them to unusual manic behavior. This is the third episode of Season 1, written by John Black, who also wrote the original episode called The Naked Time, which we'll talk about. And also another writer is J. Michael Bingham. This was directed by Paul Finch. Just kidding. I meant Paul Lynch. And it's a story arc, Polywater Intoxication. That's what Memory Mount Alpha has. Polywater Intoxication.
Yep, part 2 of 2.
Yeah, pretty much. And guest stars tonight, Brooke Bundy as Lieutenant Commander Sarah McDougal. I don't know if we ever see her again. And that is one of the interesting things about TNG, is in the first season they go through, what, 5 different chief engineers?
Yeah, and to be honest, I think I liked her as the most as the drop-in chief engineers. I think she was quite good.
Yeah. We have co-stars Benjamin Lum as Jim Shimoda. Michael Ryder as a transporter chief in a deleted scene, so I guess that really is irrelevant. David Rennan as Khan. Skip Telrach as engineering crewman. And Kenny Cook as kissing crewman. That's the name, bud. Kissing crewman. So what did we think about this episode? I like the original better. I will say that much. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. What about you, James?
Well, I'm actually a defender of this episode because I know there's a fair amount of hostility out there. I quite like the story, and I don't have huge problems with them reusing parts from TOS. And in a way, I think it provides a nice bridge to the original series. Mm-hmm. In the same way that, you know, Dr. McCoy being in the pilot, at least we know that the adventures of Kirk and co. Are still recognized and they're still part of the history. They haven't been like whitewashed or eliminated as part of a reboot or anything. So I'm actually relatively positive on this one.
Okay, well, I'm surprised Picard doesn't say, what, the Enterprise? Does everything come back to the Enterprise? Because you figure in the last one, the doctor of the Enterprise was on his ship, or he may not have even known he was on his ship. And then in the next one, here we go again with another bit of the Enterprise, which the solution was found by the same doctor that just toured his ship. Find that interesting as well. The original air date for The Naked Now was October 5th, 1987. And of course, this was the third episode of Season 1. I don't know. You know, honestly, I'm just going to go off of what it says, because I thought, well, if Encounter at Farpoint was the first episode, this should be the second. But technically, I guess Encounter could be Episodes 1 and 2, so we'll just go with 3. Keep it on track. So this is pretty much a retelling, or do we want to go into the whole Into Darkness debate and call it a reimagining of The Naked Time? Now, that synopsis was, the Enterprise is intoxicated by an inhibition-stripping contagion which causes mayhem throughout the ship. It was the sixth episode of Season 1, original air date September 29th, 1966, and again was written by John Black, directed by Mark Daniels, and again, The arc story arc was Polywater Intoxication. In this one, they were orbiting Psi 2000 as while they were trying to change the laws of physics. A frozen wasteland is about to rip apart in its death throes. The mission, pick up a scientific party and observe the planet's destruction. Everyone's dead on that scientific station, by the way, and it may appear they may have either killed each other or just killed themselves. So it's hard to say because one woman was strangled, another one was just sitting at his post looking like he didn't care, and another one was dead in the shower in his clothes. And of course, there's a landing party of two people. There's Spock and there's Joe. Okay, Joe ends up taking off his gloves and touches the table a bit, and then I think it may be blood. I'm not exactly sure what that was. It touches his hand, and he puts his glove back on in time for Spock to tell him, be sure not to come into contact with anything. So then the young ensign tells him, but sir, I took off my gloves and I touched... No, wait. No, he didn't. Instead, he keeps his mouth shut and beams back to the ship, taking the stuff with him, where the virus begins to infect everyone. They undergo physicals, which is just fine, except for, Joe, why are you whining so much? You've never been like that before. They don't know it, but Joe has the sizzle, and you're going to hear me say the sizzle a lot. And he's going to give it to everyone while holding them at bay with a butter knife. Really? Butter knife. And then there's Riley, who wants to take Kathleen home again, calling for medics when Joe cuts himself with the butter knife. So I guess you really could stab yourself with a butter knife, I suppose.
As long as you had the commitment,
yes.
You could get it done.
Right. Well, he had two guys trying to hold him down with a knife, you know, so I guess he did fall on it. Okay. So Riley gives up on Kathleen and decides to pick up on Christine. Then he takes over the ship and wants double scoops of ice cream with every meal. Sulu wants to fence everyone. Ooh, my. Another unknown crewman is playing the role of Picasso, painting Love Mankind on the wall. I wonder if this was created in the 60s. Another crewman is harassing Yeoman Rand, and Spock has to break it up. But what does he do? Instead of making sure she's safe, he just walks off and she then gets harassed again. Scotty's trying to phaser a cut in the wall so he can get into engineering. Why did he just try to phaser off the door? Would have been a lot easier. But anyway, it's going to take slightly longer than they can afford to get into engineering to stop Riley. But once they're in, whoops, the engines are off. And Scotty's got to have 13 minutes! Sorry. More importantly, Spock has a sizzle, and he and Christine Chapel fight the urge to ponfar each other, which makes Spock all weepy, and then he gets mad at Jim, and, well, let's be honest, Jim does slap him a few times, so I guess he got a bloody lip out of it. That's his problem. In the end, it's a bit noisy, and, you know, everybody's ears almost explode, but Scotty does it. He rescues the ship in time. He didn't have to have 13 minutes. He had 3, which is an interesting thought in itself. But anyway, he puts the ship backwards in time. Okay, cue cheesy music here. Into a time warp. That could be an interesting, you know, James, I tell you, that could be an interesting plot point in itself. So, but what they do is they reverse time, and they have to live the last 3 days over again. But Spock points out, since the formula worked, they can go back in time anytime they wish to. But do they? And that's your bit about history today. So, no, let's go into the naked now.
The reverse time thing doesn't work. That's not how it works.
But according to them, they could go anywhere in space and any time.
Yeah, they can spend they can just spend their time, you know, visiting the past if they choose to. It's one thing that I always find to be a little bit added on to that episode. They get thrown off. They go back in time. The clocks run backwards, which is weird. The clocks run backwards, but somehow the humans don't run backwards. So it's almost as if the clock has to be an absolute accurate depiction of time, but a clock is nothing more than a physical object that you just set to count. It doesn't natively measure time. It it just sits there and it ticks by. So I always get really confused by that. And it's strange because I don't think that particular point even needs to be on the TOS episode. If you didn't have the flight back 3 days, does it really change anything?
No.
It happens. What's added? Yeah, it happens. It's by, and then it's never picked up again. It is picked up. Is it picked up in a? It's either Return to Tomorrow or Tomorrow is Yesterday. I get those two confused.
That was a slingshot. I don't know if they did some kind of. They never said that we pulled out the Coca-Cola original formula and took us back in time. No,
that's true. But I always thought that this was the fundamental of the slingshot. I thought that's what they were getting at with how they got out this way. Anyway, I'm not a Watson. I'm not Scotty. So
right. Okay, so. Yeah. Anyway, back to the Naked Now. So they're checking out the SS Tsiolkovsky, right? And the biggest question of the day is, how many pretty boys are there on the Enterprise D? Well, let's why don't we list go through the names of the pretty boys on the Enterprise? Could we? I mean, there's Riker, but he doesn't have his beard yet, so he's not all that good looking just yet. Yeah, kind of handsome, but I don't know.
And am I the only one that actually? I thought that the voice from the Tsiolkovsky sounded a little bit like Janeway. Or at least I heard that. However, she didn't come across as being the most discriminatory type. I don't think she would have turned away any pretty boys, beard or not.
Right, that's true. I mean, I think she, probably would have even had her way with Wesley if possible. Which Wesley in this episode was completely wrong, and we're going to get to that part later. I do not understand where they thought of writing Wesley the way they did. It makes no sense to me. That is so. Data's a pretty something. How about the young ensign that gets kissed? I don't think he's all that good looking.
No. I think we can leave it at Riker,
okay,
and hope that he can take care of the entire crew.
Okay, so when the spokesperson for the Tsiolkovsky says, "I hope you have a lot of pretty boys," the only one that raised his hand was Riker. Got it. Okay. So what are they doing? The Tsiolkovsky is the one who's who's watching the collapse of a red supergiant star into a white dwarf. So
an extreme close range, or perhaps a dangerously close range.
Absolutely. So I had done something once. I actually did. I printed out, and I've subsequently lost it, the definitions of these things. So the red giant is a very large, relatively cool star formed when a maiden sequence star runs out of hydrogen and begins fusing helium. Some red giants are considered B-class stars. That explained everything, didn't it?
Yes, I mean, that's true.
Yes.
As stars get older, they get bigger.
Right.
And they expand. And then as it, when you talk about it going red, being red rather than white, you're just talking about it being colder.
Right. And the white dwarf is a star formed when a red giant runs out of helium fuel after losing most of its mass into space. Of course, I just explained that very well as well. So there's that. Okay. What's the difference between sucked out and blown out?
Well, that's something that I've got on my list of lessons learned from this episode.
Mm-hmm. What, is it better to be sucked than blowed? What?
I first watched this episode, it must have been 11 or so, and I found it hilarious to be able to correct people that you are not you're not sucked out into space, but you are blown out. But I think it's got all to do with where the air is going, right? So if you're going out with the air, or if you're coming in because of air's been sucked in.
That's true. I guess it'd be more like sucked in and blown out. That's true. But you could be, I don't know, could you be blown? You can't be blown in, but sucked out or blown in. Wow. Where have we gone on our third episode, huh? Okay, so what do we have? They check out the Tsiolkovsky, and Geordi finds a crewman showering in her clothing. And, of course, she falls on him, and then we hear the sizzle sound, otherwise to be known as getting the virus. I call it the sizzle. And so that's, I guess that's our cue that someone's being infected.
Yes, I never quite understood. I mean, I assume that the people in the episode don't hear this. This is a musical cue that's been put over the top for the audience.
Yes.
But, I mean, I don't particularly think it's necessary. And they did it as well with the Naked Time, right?
Right.
They had the they had the same kind of cue. I suppose it helps you keep track of, you know, who's been infected and who hasn't.
Here, that's what I'll do. Right about now, since we said we weren't going to do very many clips, I'm going to do one right here. This one's going to be, this sound that you're about to hear is going to be the original series, The Naked Time Sizzle, when somebody gets infected. All right, and this one is going to be The Next Generation, when somebody gets infected on The Naked Now. Here's that sizzle.
I mean, I think we can both agree there's been 20 years worth of progress there.
In the sizzle?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I guess it could be about the same, or maybe not. Maybe they're not the same, I don't know. Well, it doesn't matter. Do you think maybe Gene Roddenberry had to go deep into the archive to find the sizzle? Damn it, Nigel, I know there's a sizzle in here somewhere. Let's find a sizzle. Shut up, Gene. Why don't I just make another steak? Here. Anyway. So, 80 or so people on the Tsiolkovsky. They must have all gotten sizzled, I guess, because now Geordi brings it back. And so what happens... What happened to the biofilters is what my notes say. What happened to the transporter biofilters? On the original one, they go through decontamination, and that didn't work. And on this one, they go through the biofilters. But let's step back one thing about decontamination. Did you notice their suits that Spock and Joe were wearing?
Yes.
And he was able to take his glove off and then put his hand up over into his face.
Yes, that they weren't airtight suits.
No, they were not airtight suits. So, obviously, Joe was probably going to get the sizzle anyway. I mean, I'm sure Spock would have gotten it, too.
And I think in the Naked Now, this is the only mention of maximum decontamination. Almost suggesting that, you know, you could do maximum decontamination, or you could just do a little bit of decontamination. Mm. Depends how much you consider the nasty virus to be a threat.
Right.
But no messing around this time. Well, proper maximum decontamination.
Well, I wonder how many of the ladies out there wish they could have had Spock and Joe in a decontamination room rubbing jelly on each other. I digress way too much. Okay. I don't want that image in my head. Okay, so Geordi's getting hot. He is getting hot. He flips off at Crusher about it being too hot in sickbay. Riker says that, you know, it doesn't sound like him. Well, how would Riker know exactly how Geordi sounds? They've only been together for a little bit of time, unless maybe Geordi and Riker served together on, what was it, the Hood? Was he on the Hood, or where was he at before he came to the Enterprise?
I don't believe that he was on the Hood. Obviously, they are together at Farpoint, so I think he's probably dropped off at Farpoint from on the Hood. But I don't think he does serve. It's mentioned much later on in Identity Crisis, when Geordi turns into a little reptile thing with all the blue veins. There's footage there of him pre-Enterprise, and I think it gets mentioned, but I don't think it's the Hood, but I'm happy to be corrected.
Well, because there was the one ship that Riker refused to let Captain DeSoto beam down to the planet because he thought it was too dangerous.
I thought that was the Hood.
Was it? Oh, well, then it might be. Let me see. What other ship did Riker serve as a first officer. People are right now going, "Geez, come on, guys, you should know this stuff."
See, you're now taking the role of Data does during this episode when Riker comes up to him with a query. Data probably could have used a bit of Google at that point, because I'm pretty sure you'll find this quicker than Data was able to find Riker's query.
Right. Well, gee, I don't know about that. Yeah, he did need a few hours, but yeah, I could be a while. Riker's commanding officer on the Hood, it has to be the Hood, was Captain Robert DeSoto. So obviously Picard took Riker straight off the Hood. Oh, I bet you Captain DeSoto was a little upset.
I mean, so, you know, when I mentioned right at the top of the show, I mentioned that I didn't particularly mind how this borrows some of the ideas from the TOS script. I do have to say, though, that, you know, when you went through the TOS goings on, I think that they are a bit too similar. You know, in both cases, the Enterprise comes to a place, whether it's the outpost or whether it's the starship. They've experienced it. They've been both wiped out. They come across with the same illness or contagion. You both get the ticking clock threat build up as the end of the episode, and then you have, like, you know, being saved just in time. And I would have, you know, although I don't particularly mind the way that they borrow from TOS, I think that they didn't have to do such a kind of like cut and paste jobby there.
Right.
I think they could have touched upon this without having to have, you know, you didn't need to have the science ship there. You didn't need to have the same ticking clock threat build up as, you know, as the Enterprise was approaching its doom. So one way or another, I think they could have been cleverer with how they handled the inherited story.
Right. And the whole idea of somebody taking a shower in his or her clothing, I think that's so weird that Data should have had that immediately. I mean, Riker remembered it. Why would Riker remember somebody taking a shower in his or her clothing and Data would have no clue?
It's also, from a production point of view, that's a strange thing to kind of connect the two episodes, right?
Right.
You know, there's... You could have used it at that point, or you could have used it as a, you know, I remember there once was a ship where everyone went crazy and, you know, people started running around the place trying to fence. It seems strange that the shower and the clothing became the connector between the two episodes, because I never felt watching The Naked Time that, you know, the iconic images you take away from The Naked Time, it's not the guy showering in his clothes.
No.
So it's strange that you know, Riker took that away.
Right. And then there was once a woman from Venus whose body was shaped like a... So anyway, so they do a library search of somebody taking a shower and his clothing, obviously the homage to TOS, as you say.
Can I just step in here with some observations on Data? Because actually, Data's my favorite character in TNG. Kind of like, certainly growing up, I was kind of like the nerdy kid, and he was fundamentally the nerdy kid that had superhuman strength and ability to solve all problems. So I think that, you know, I liked him a lot. I think that this episode is a little bit strange that. I find that some of the dialogue, certainly early TNG dialogue with Data, can sometimes be a bit clunky. But I do enjoy the way he speaks and the way he's spoken to, both in the scene right at the beginning with Crusher, where, you know, he points out that he's already written up in a technical, in a medical journal, and then also when Riker comes to him and says, you know, I've got this feeling, I remember reading about someone showering their clothes, and the first thing Data does is he goes, ah, Geordi found that body just, you know, half an hour ago. And I think he's being, those lines are quite nice, and I think it feeds into his like childlike persona at this stage, and I quite, you know, I personally do like that, and I think he's well written in some instances. There are other occasions in this episode where he's like, you know, facepalmly badly written. He's still doing the inquiry, you know, snootful, and that's, you know, that's painful to hear. But some of the good Data kind of dialogue and you know, back and forth with other members is coming through at this stage, I think.
Right. Okay. Well, how many guys out there noticed the hottie leaving the bridge after Riker talks with Data? Oh, was that skirt hiked up?
I get the impression there are more extras in early TNG, because you do get a lot of traffic in the background. I feel like you get less of that as the series progresses, but maybe I'm just misremembering.
Now, you want to talk a little bit about Wesley's portable tractor beam?
Oh, yes.
how come that never takes off?
It's strange. I mean, this is obviously his science project. I assume that... what do you think that runs on? It's probably a fair amount of energy to give to a child, right?
Yeah, you would think so. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's a big 9-volt battery in there or something.
I think there's enough damage that you can do with a tractor beam that you probably shouldn't hand it over to a child.
And then there's the voice recorder where he can pretend to be anybody he wants to be, and he could be the captain or...
Actually, I mean, you mentioned at the beginning of the show how you didn't, you know, you were going to mention Wesley and, bad things about Wesley. I am an apologist for Wesley, but one thing that does make me cringe, and I kind of mentioned it, last week, I think the reaction to Wesley is really the worst thing about Wesley. So when you first see the tractor beam and the voice recorder and he's talking to Geordi, I think the most offensive thing about the scene is how Geordi's kind of like, hey, Wesley, you're really something. And I think that just completely turns you against the Wesley character. Later on in the episode, they ended with everyone saying, did they mean Wesley, the boy? And Wesley? Yes, we meant Wesley. And I think all of that builds up the hatred towards Wesley.
Right.
Him in itself, I don't think he's that bad. Even in this episode, it's the reaction to him that I think is the facepalm moments.
Well, yeah, I know. I think part of it is it's the idea. If you went on a luxury cruise right now, okay, with Carnival Cruise Lines or any of them, and you found out that a 14-year-old kid was at the helm, how would you feel about that? I would have a hard time with that.
No, absolutely. I think that is true. But I'd feel worse if that bigging up this 14-year-old kid, in a way.
Yeah.
So if it was taken as a matter of fact, I think it's better than saying, whoa, we've got this really great kid that's, he really is something. He's done his own tractor beam in his spare time, and we've now put him in charge of the helm.
Right. I guess in the end, Wesley was a cute kid, I will say that. He seemed like a very nice boy, and he was just so fascinating. He's the geek of the ship. He knows more than a lot of the adults do. And he just wants to do it all. I admire that, actually. So, and there are some shows where Wesley does save the day, even when someone like Data tries to ruin the day. So, but anyway, Geordi ends up giving Wesley the sizzle and staggers out of Wesley's house saying, why is it so hot? Let's see. Do you think Wesley would have known that there was a ship-wide search for Geordi?
I would have thought he must have done. I mean, what's the point of being ship-wide if it's going to be ship-wide except this 90% of the ship here, or however much it was? He must have known that.
And, even Alexandra, who was probably about 2 or 3 at this point in the series, if she was on the ship, she would have known that they were looking for Geordi. She would have turned him in a second, I know it. But anyway, so Geordi walks out, and Wesley's now got the sizzle. And this is where I have a problem with this, okay? One of the scenes is Tasha cruising about, and the camera is actually at her ass level, okay? I mean, it's watching her butt wiggle all the way down the hallway. And personally, I have no problem with that. It's just that Wesley, when he gets the sizzle, what does he do? Okay, he's 14. He's probably got enough testosterone pumping inside of his body right now that it's about ready to squirt out his ears, right? He's got no other girls on the ship. He's probably has no idea what, you know, a girl's like, but yet I'm sure he likes them. So when he gets the sizzle, what does he do? He wants to go to engineering and play captain.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, you might have assumed that he would be straight to the holodeck or something.
Right. Right.
But yeah, that's strange. What's your opinion of, I mean, we've just jumped slightly over the point where, I mean, LaForge ends up in the observation deck, and you know, when he gives Tasha Yar the sizzle, I've always felt a little uncomfortable with, I don't really like the way that Geordi in particular behaves in this episode. He starts going on about normal sight, and to be honest, I think it does his character slightly a disservice.
I'm not sure about that. I don't think so. I really don't. I think, you know, he obviously has longed for normal vision his entire life. They've wanted to do certain things to help him get normal vision, and he realizes he never will get normal vision. So when he loses his ability to his grip on life, I think that's when it comes out, and he wants to see Tasha in ways that, you know, other people can see her. And it's turned around when he does get normal sight. We're spoiling up future episodes, but he does get normal sight. What does he do? He turns around and looks at her and says, "You're even more beautiful than I imagined." So no, I think when you put the two scenes together, the future one and this one, it actually is touching to me.
Oh, so yeah, actually, sorry, I had forgotten that future scene. When you were mentioning when he gets future sight, I'm thinking all the way to Insurrection.
No.
Here. No. But no, you're right. He does, something happens in the coming weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I suppose I can see that. It's actually, I mean, one of the things that, I mean, it's one of the criticisms that sometimes gets thrown at this episode is that you start to see a lot of the characters, you know, behaving, you know, drunk, or at least without inhibitions. And I mean, the argument would go that you don't know the characters well enough to be able to appreciate them like out of character. Mm-hmm. But I actually usually, you know, I counter that by saying that what you're probably trying to see, and certainly if it's, you know, if it's well written, is you're trying to see that what's slightly underneath the surface. Mm-hmm. So the thing that is underneath the surface that needs to be controlled, that you might not necessarily, you might only get glimpses at. And I think in that respect, I do think they do a relatively good job. Some characters in particular work better than others. But when you do see all of the crew in these in this extreme state, I think it's telling that, you know, people like Riker and Worf, they're still very much at their posts. Wesley, yes, you're right, he goes off and he goes and, you know, plays captain, I assume, you know, showing what his real ultimate fancy would be if he didn't have to adhere to the kind of like the protocols of everyday life. So I do, you know, I actually think that it kind of gives a decent insight, even at this early stage, into the characters. I always had problems with LaForge in the sense that I never picked up. I accept the scene coming up in a couple of weeks' time, but if we are talking about, you know, season 3, season 4, LaForge, I never got the impression that he was pining for real sight, and that's perhaps why I am. You know, that's perhaps why I'm slightly less enthusiastic about how he behaves throughout the episode.
Well, maybe that's, and it could also be because in these present episodes, he's not the chief engineer of the flagship of the Federation. So at this point, he probably never considered he'd ever go so high. So maybe, you know, because he's in constant pain due to this visor, and he probably has always wished he could get normal sight, and he wishes he could see the sunset, the sunrise, and see things like other people do. You know, you see better than me. Well, I don't see better. I see different. And, you know, he wishes he could see like everyone else. So, Wesley, you're right. Wesley, his ambition is to be a starship captain, straight up. Tasha, who knows? Maybe her ambition is just to be a horn dog. You know, Troy, She, in her mind, she really wishes she could go back to the days when her and Riker were together. So yeah, I think that's what this intoxication does. It brings out their deepest wishes.
I mean, it's very clear that, you know, regarding the Troi-Riker relationship, it's very clear both from this episode, when Troi tries to get Riker to, you know, to go off with her, and also in previously an encounter at Farpoint at the end, where Troi suggests that she and Riker would, you know, should go down to the tunnels by themselves and have a look around. It's very clear that Troi is still pushing for the relationship, whereas Riker, he's clearly moved on. At this point, at least, he's very focused on, you know, being the first officer of the flagship, and then, you know, taking his step on his career forward. And I think that's, you know, I think it's very clear. It's not the case that it's, you know, will they or won't they? I think at this stage in the series, you know, Troi is still hoping, and Riker's turned that option off.
Right. Yes, he still hears her thoughts, but he's trying to stop. So that's another interesting question that we never discussed in the last one. When they first meet each other and she says, "Can you still read my thoughts? Do you remember how?" And you can see his eyes like, yeah. So does that mean that he can read her thoughts all the time? Or is she able to decide when he should read her thoughts and when she shouldn't?
Do you know, I think the scene is ambiguous enough to be taken as, can Riker hear her or not.
So in other words, I think what she, I'm sorry to interrupt, but what I think she does, she FTPs into Riker's brain when she wants him to upload some of her thoughts and when she doesn't.
I always read it as she tried to communicate and Riker couldn't hear her. Because it would be a pretty nifty trick to have up your sleeve, right? In you know, in future episodes,
yes.
If you can telepathically communicate with someone, I don't think it. I mean, unless I'm mistaken, I don't think it comes up again.
My goodness, you know something? You are so right. Why doesn't she do this with the captain or anybody, anyone in key figure, so she could actually be on the other side of the room looking at? Supposedly she's being held captive, looking at a screen that has the Romulan defense codes, and she could telepathically tell that to Picard. I mean, why doesn't she do it to everybody? That's fascinating.
I mean, it certainly comes up when her mother comes onto the ship, and okay. they have the back and forth telepathic communication, which I think some of that's done pretty well, and it's a nice back and forth whilst. You know, fundamentally, the actors aren't saying anything, and but yeah, I always read it that she, you know, she probably wanted to communicate still, but Riker wasn't he wasn't at the races at that time.
Right. So if her and her mother were in a turbo lift with a good-looking young man standing between them, and then Mrs. Troi says something to Deanna, and Deanna says, "No, mother, I don't wish to jump his bones at this time." Okay, what do you think that man's thinking right now? Okay. Back to the naked now. So now, did you notice when Data is still searching through the records, did you notice the bird?
Yes, the great bird of the galaxy.
The great bird of the galaxy. Now, there were others, include some Klingon symbols, some star charts, the United Federation of Planets logo, a shot of the original Enterprise, and I'm sure there were probably others that I didn't pick up.
No, yes, and I have to say, I do. I mean, it's stuff we take for granted, right? Being Star Trek fans, having watched it for however many years, but you know, as a kid watching this, it's pretty cool to see a guy sitting there with text just flash up in front of his eyes and him being able to read it.
Right.
I think, you know, that's certainly a lot of the stuff that got me into Star Trek was how much of a wow factor a lot of this was. These were, you know, Data is. He's a superhuman in the way that he can do this, and that always appealed to me.
Right.
We kind of take it for granted that he's, you know, super strong, super fast. He can read whatever he needs to be. He's clever and whatnot. But watching it the first time, this was really I enjoyed Data showing us what he could do.
Yeah. Then we have Tasha breaking into Troi's quarters. Now, question. Do you think all of Deanna's off-duty clothes are see-through?
Well, Tasha does mention how lovely she looks when she's not on duty, so I can only assume the answer is yes.
Yeah. Why didn't we ever get to see some of those clothes on Deanna? Okay. So she plants Tasha still. She plants the big wet one on a young crewman. But, of course, I think at the same time that she's planting the wet one on the crewman, I'm still eyeing the young ensign behind him, walking with that hiked-up skirt. I wonder where she was heading.
She's getting away from Riker, just to be on the safe side.
So, okay, now, the star is about to explode, right? And the ship can outrun anything that the red giant could throw at it at one-half impulse. In other words, barring anything going wrong, they could pretty much crawl away from it, right? No problem, Cap. Right? You think?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Uh-oh. James is gone.
No, I'm still here.
It's wondering why you're so quiet.
Sorry, can you hear me? Hello?
Wait a minute. Okay, hold on. I think that was my fault. Oh, there you are.
Can you hear me?
There we go. I was pushing forward, and my headset was turning itself down. I didn't realize that. Sorry about that.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, I can hear you perfect now. So I'll,
okay, super.
Obviously, I probably walked over a lot of what you said, thinking you weren't there.
No. I didn't think. I'm pretty sure we are. I think I must have just disappeared. Seconds before you mentioned anything.
Yeah, okay. Let's see. So the entire ship gets infected. The young ensign, the other one. The ship can... Oh, okay, so anyway, I was saying about the ship can outrun anything so they could crawl away from it unless something goes wrong. And obviously, something goes wrong.
It was almost asking for someone to say, well, perhaps we should just move out of the way to be on the safe side. Mm-hmm. It was, can we outrun it? Yes. Is there any reason for us to be here? Could we just tractor the science ship away? Well, we probably could, but, we could still outrun it, so let's hang around in the needless danger for a couple of hours.
It's hard to believe that they need all those isolinear chips to move the ship around. I mean, don't they have a manual thing? A stick shift?
Yes, no, perhaps.
Put some coal in the boiler or something.
I mean, I think it's also strange that something's on, relatively prominent display, that if you happen to yank it or, maybe if you just happen to kick it, the entire thing stops working. So it's not exactly, it's not exactly behind six or seven doors that you can only get through with a security code and whatnot. This was pretty prominently on display.
Okay. So do you think maybe Gene Roddenberry was trying to stick it to the studio by making the security chief a woman, the chief medical officer a woman, the chief engineer a woman, the counselor a woman. There's only a couple men in command now. I think it's funny. I think it's great that he was forward thinking enough to say, well, why can't a woman be a chief engineer? Why can't she be the head of security? And at the time, since the studio and the original series wouldn't let him do that, I thought it was kind of interesting that he would choose to put women in these key roles. Do you agree with that at all?
Absolutely. I think that, I think Crusher being chief medical is, medical is perhaps a little bit softer than the other roles. But certainly Yara's chief security is a very strong and a very positive, in my opinion, female character.
Right.
And again, the chief engineer happens to have turned up and happens to be a woman. And I don't know why she didn't return. And I don't think she did return. I think there were a couple of chief engineers that came back, once or twice. I don't think she came back. But I didn't think there was anything particularly wrong with, you know, the performance or anything.
I think she just got angry at all those chips laying on the floor and says, I can't take this no more. So she went back to the ship's sewing room.
Either that or, you know, after the episode had finished, Picard sat down with her and said, you left who in charge of engineering alone? Don't you realize even a child could, you know, could trick him into giving up control of the entire ship?
Well, I don't really think she was thinking along those lines at the time.
Well, I mean, I don't think Jim comes across as being the smartest tool in the box, right? The assistant chief engineer.
No.
So maybe he was on a, you know, he was on special duty, and she had to look after him, and the fact that she didn't, you know, she got sacked over.
Yeah, so the chief engineer was just called to the bridge, and now the assistant chief engineer is being called to medical, and they both go, well, there's nothing wrong with that. It happens all the time, which we'll have to leave Wesley in command of the engineering. Well, isn't there another engineer that could, you know, take over? Isn't there a third in command?
No, none.
No.
Because there's a thousand, well, over 1,000 people on board.
Right.
But as you'll see in the episode, there's one person in sick bay. Mm-hmm. Never more than one person in sickbay,
right.
And only two people in engineering.
Right.
The rest of them are on the archaeology expedition, I think.
The lower decks. I gotcha. Okay, so Acting Captain West orders that dessert shall precede and follow every meal, including breakfast. I shall endeavor to follow your every word, Captain. So, what is metaphysics?
I don't know.
Well, then I think we should do a search. Metaphysics.
It's got nothing to do with physics. I know that much. I thought it was kind of like some sort of spirituality-based nonsense that's dressed up as pseudoscience. But now I'm going to get hate mail.
I was just going to say, somebody's going to write us. Metaphysics is a subfield of philosophy that examines the nature of reality, including relationships between the mind and matter. It can also deal with cosmology.
So basically the Traveler, right?
Pretty much, I guess. Okay. And of course, it once was a lady from Venus who we're not going to go through that again. Picard sends Data to get Tasha, but ends up defining fully functional and looking pretty... my note says, and looking ravaging, I must say. In other words, I'm not talking about Data. I think I'm talking about Tasha there. So when she... he got to her quarters and he goes in there. What do you think about the way she was dressed?
I think that, I mean, she's clearly dressed for the occasion. But there's something I really love about this scene. And I don't know if anyone else picks up on this. But when Data goes in, and again, Data's very innocent at this point in the series. and he says, you know, I've been ordered to take you to sick bay. You know, the captain's ordered me to take you to sick bay. And then she says, did he say when? And you can see that Data, for a certain extent, is stumped by that. It's like, well, I'm sure he meant now. But you can just see her planting this, a little seed of doubt. Mm-hmm. When she said, did he say when? And I enjoy that a lot.
So the computer didn't go, Data to Picard, when did you want her in sick bay? You know, if the boss tells you to do something and is ambiguous about it, then let's find out what he really wants. But that's okay. Mm-hmm. So Picard tries to get – well, so anyway, that's how when they define fully functional. She talks about the rape gangs and how she survived and how old she was at the time. And so it was an interesting story that we'll obviously touch on again later. But go ahead.
So what I was going to mention is that am I the only person that finds it a little bit hard to believe that Data is fully functional with, you know, programmed in a wide variety of techniques? I can't help but think back at, obviously Data's an android. He was created. There must have been a huge number of problems that, you know, his creator had to overcome. So he had to get the entire skeleton thing working, make sure that he's got the proper strength. You have to obviously program the positronic net, so he becomes a, he realizes consciousness, and he fully becomes, an android that is self-aware and whatnot. And at some point he thinks, do you know what he's missing? He's not quite fully functional. And then he must sit down and then think, well, I would bring Data into the world, next Tuesday to this big conference I'm going to, but he's not quite fully functional, so I'm going to have to spend the next 6 months or so programming his lower regions.
No, all he needs to do is download everything from the Penthouse forum, and poof, he's got it all done.
And well, okay. even if we take that as true, at this point, I'm now thinking, what kind of beta testing did Data go through? He must have tried this stuff out. Later in a couple of years, we see another android, just activated and having difficulty even swallowing water and eating. And Data must have had to, there must have been a lot of bug fixes in that particular subroutine to get through. And I don't think I want to think, why the father of modern, modern artificial intelligence felt the need to include this in his brand new prototype android.
Fascinating. So he had to use a lot of patches because some of the programming wasn't quite right. Like, he put him in situations where Data started to hump everything. So he had to get, a little better job than becoming fully functional. That's the best I can come up with. Okay, well, we better stop on that one. It's just going to get worse from there. Picard tries to get Wesley to release control to him, but Wesley just wants to carry out Picard's orders. Okay, so instead of butting heads with Wesley, why not say, because Wesley says, Skipper, you tell me what you want done and I'll do it. No, Wesley, I want control. Now, why not just go, okay, Wesley, here's what I would like. Put the chips back in and set a course out of here because we're going to die. Engage. And then when it's done, kick his butt.
Absolutely. When you have Wesley in this position, you play along with him, you use a bit of subterfuge, and then you get him. You don't try to go up against him. I think it's silly. What Picard should have said is that, hey, Wesley, we think you're great. Can you come up to the bridge? I'm going to give you my chair. And he would have come up to the bridge, and then Worf would have taken him out.
Phaser shot.
Instead, there's this idea that you have to confront Wesley, and it's clearly not going to work.
No, it ain't going to work. And speaking of Picard, this I don't get. Crusher is coming on to him, right? Oh, Captain. And just as she's about to attack him, you hear this. What the heck was that?
I actually quite like that. I think it's actually quite a nice scene. It's a funny scene. I suppose he's trying to sober up, I suppose. Sober her up.
And clearing his throat does that?
I don't know. He must have had experience.
So now Patrick Stewart's reading the script. He goes, Crusher comes on to Picard. Crusher tries to give him a kiss. Captain clears his throat. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's all it was. Doctor.
There's one thing I'd like to say about Crusher in this episode, because I'm a Crusher fan. I like Crusher. I like Gates McFadden as well. I think she does a decent job at portraying Crusher. But this episode tries to make her out to be completely incompetent. I don't know if you noticed that. So on her list of things that she didn't do right, first of all, Geordi's clearly infected with something, but she doesn't really quarantine anyone. So she's pretty lapsed on that front. She then loses Geordi, which to me just sounds ridiculous.
Right.
There's a scene around halfway, actually relatively early on, where Picard does ask her, is there any chance of this being a disease? The other crew killed themselves. What are we looking at here? What are the risks? And she plays it down. She said, no chance of it being a disease and whatnot. She's very much this isn't going to be a medical issue. It might be someone going, crazy, but it's not a medical thing. And then when Data finds McCoy's answer in the textbooks and sends it down to her, Crusher fundamentally has all of McCoy's research plus better tools over the last 8 years or so, and still can't do anything with it until right at the end of the episode.
Right.
And she's sitting on McCoy's answer for around, for a good half of the episode, she's sitting with McCoy's work going, I don't quite understand what he's doing. It's almost as if she just has no medical expertise at all.
Right.
I like Crusher, but I felt that in this episode she was written to be slightly less than competent.
Yes.
And all of this stuff that she did do was before she was drunk as well. So
right.
It was before she became infected. I think had it been any other doctor, straight away, or certainly the first sign of it spreading, quarantine whoever has had contact with them, make people go back to their quarters. I mean, she even suggests to Wesley that he should go back to his quarters to stay out of the way because she's a bit worried.
Right.
But she won't quarantine the crew that have been in contact with Geordi.
Yeah, Phlox would have been on top of it.
I think so.
Yep. Okay. All right, well, we better hurry up. We're pushing this one. Yes. All right, so let's go. Data's trying to put back the chips in the command module, and he says there just isn't enough time. So why doesn't two or three people try to help him? Why doesn't Riker get down there and put some chips in too?
Oh, I think Riker would be in
the way.
In the way.
Yeah, I suppose. Or how about the boy genius? The boy.
I like the way how... as you are coming towards the end of the episode and, the threat is building, I think it's actually a relatively clever trick that they use because the action is taking place now in engineering as Data's doing his extremely fast hand movements. There's a bit where Wesley puts the main viewer on the side monitor.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it does become this ticking clock.
Right.
You see the core fragment getting closer and closer to the Sierkowski, and it becomes the thing to be aware of as people are trying to fix it and save the day. And I quite like that.
And so all they need to do is just find a way to push the Sierkowski into the core fragment, and it would take weeks to do. Well, why not just see it in your head?
Yeah, that's this is the worst written line for Wesley up to this point.
Yeah, just see it in your head.
Because you know, just see it in your head. Shut up, Wesley.
Shut up, Wesley. Yeah, but of course, Picard is the one who usually does a shut up, Wesley, but he's busy going back to sickbay where he does his little hop in the air as he's walking in. That was funny.
I thought it was funny. And it's a quite nice scene as they're sitting there. Really, both of them completely out of it, and it even gets to the point where Crusher has managed to find the antidote and can't quite remember that fact.
Right.
So add that to the list.
Cool enough. So that's it. Wesley saves the day. He kind of messes up the day. He kind of saves the day. So I'm doing a list of what happens in the episodes, who tries to take over the ship, and who saves the day. And I'm also trying to do how many crewmen died. So we're also going to – I'll keep all that information. And then at the end of each season, we're going to talk about how many crewmen died, who tries to take over the ship most, who saves the day the most, and what our average ratings were for that season. And then assuming that you and I are still alive when we get to season 7 – and then we'll talk about our average ratings for the entire run. So that is... Go ahead.
Can we make it into a graph? I like graphs.
I'll let you do the graph, sir. I'll let you do all the math you want to do. You're the doctor here, not me. All right, so it's now time to give a rating for this episode from 1 to 5, with 1 being Stinky Bombs. And 5 being hip hip hooray. I could come up with something better than that. I'd just go 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. So what do you give this one, James?
Well, actually, as I mentioned right at the beginning, I'm I'm a bit of an apologist for this episode. I quite like it. I think one thing that's good about it is that it's quite nicely paced, and the mood of the episode kind of changes from, you know, the mystery at the beginning to descending into a little bit of comedy and farce to actually, I think, they dial up the threat quite nicely at the end. I don't have problems with the connection to TOS. I think that overall, I would give this guy a three out of five.
Okay. Yeah, same thing. I liked the bit with Geordi. I think I may have changed your mind a little bit on the direction that they were taking with Geordi and his wanting of Vision. I'm not sure I go for the android rape, because you got to figure he's like a little kid, okay? Data is pretty much like a little kid. He's still growing up in this world, and she pretty much takes him. I'm not sure I thought that was very appropriate. Her wanting to try on Deanna's see-through clothing, I wish I could have seen her in them and not just in front of her, but that's okay. I can go without the redoing of the original series, but being an homage to the original series, I'm okay with. I like that as well. In the end, I'll give this a 3 as well. In the end, about a 3. Or we can even go half numbers if you want. I'll even go 1/4. But anyway, so a 3 for you and a 3 for me.
I don't believe in half numbers.
You don't? Why? They are there. They're real.
No, they are there. They are real. It's not that I question the reality of the number line or anything. I'll put it this way. I don't think many people have the ability to internally distinguish between a 7.5 and an 8.
Oh, really?
I just don't think we're, you know, I think at best I can give something, you know, a thumbs up, two thumbs up, or maybe even three thumbs up. I find it difficult to split it any finer than that.
Okay, James, when you're able to give somebody three thumbs up, I want to do this on video so we can get a picture of that, okay?
Three thumbs up is my go-to top marks.
I know, but it's physically impossible for you to give three thumbs up, unless there's something about you we don't know, that you're the only one that has three thumbs, but we'll see. Or bring one of your kids in and, hey, put your thumb up. Why, Daddy? Just do it.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
You must get the vaccine from the planet, Captain, immediately.
On a desperate life-saving mission, Lieutenant Yar falls prey to kidnappers.
Photon torpedoes ready, sir.
Fire.
You shall have no vaccine and no Lieutenant Yar!
And the deadly trade-off begins.
I challenge you. A struggle to the death.
It's a fight for survival on Star Trek The Next Generation.
And that is The Naked Now. All right, so stick around next time, ladies and gentlemen, for the next episode, which is Code of Honor, also known as
No Vaccine, No Treaty, and No Lieutenant Yar.
I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
And we'll be back next week. Good night.